Master Audio presents Don't Sweat the Small Stuff, and It's All Small Stuff. Written and read by Richard Carlson, PhD.
The greatest discovery of my generation is that a human being can alter his life by altering his attitude. William James. Whenever we're dealing with bad news, a difficult person, or a disappointment of some kind, most of us get into certain habits, ways of reacting to life, particularly adversity, that don't serve us very well. We overreact, blow things out of proportion, hold on too tightly, and focus on the negative aspects of life. When we are immobilized by the little things, when we are irritated, annoyed, and easily bothered, our overreactions not only make us frustrated, but actually get in the way of getting what we want. We lose sight of the bigger picture, focus on the negative, and annoy other people who might otherwise help us. In short, we live our lives as if they were one great big emergency. We often rush around looking busy, trying to solve problems, but in reality, we are often compounding them. Because everything seems like such a big deal, we end up spending our lives dealing with one drama after another. After a while, we begin to believe that everything really is a big deal. We fail to recognize that the way we relate to our problems has a lot to do with how quickly and efficiently we solve them. As I hope you will soon discover, when you learn the habit of responding to life with more ease, problems that seemed insurmountable will begin to seem more manageable. And even the biggies, things that are truly stressful, won't throw you off track as much as they once did. Happily, there is another way to relate to life, a softer, more graceful path that makes life seem easier and the people in it more compatible. This other way of living involves replacing old habits of reaction with new habits of perspective. These new habits enable us to have richer, more satisfying lives. For more than a decade, I have worked with clients, helping them to approach life in this more accepting way. Together, we deal with all types of issues, stress, relationship problems, work-related issues, addictions, and general frustration. In this audiobook, I will share with you very specific strategies, things you can start doing today that will help you respond to life more gracefully. The strategies you are going to hear are the ones that have proven themselves to be the most successful by clients and readers of mine over the years. They also represent the way I like to approach my own life, the path of least resistance. Each strategy is simple, yet powerful, and will act as a navigational guide to point you in the direction of greater perspective and more relaxed living. You'll find that many of the strategies will apply not only to isolated events, but to many of life's most difficult challenges. When you don't sweat the small stuff, your life won't be perfect, but you will learn to accept what life has to offer with far less resistance. As we learn in the Zen philosophy, when you learn to let go of problems instead of resisting with all your might, your life will begin to flow. You will, as the Serenity Prayer suggests, change the things that can be changed, accept those that cannot, and have the wisdom to know the difference. I'm confident that if you give these strategies a try, you will learn the two rules of harmony. Number one, don't sweat the small stuff. And number two, it's all small stuff. As you incorporate these ideas into your life, you will begin to create a more peaceful and loving you.
Make peace with imperfection.
I've yet to meet an absolute perfectionist whose life was filled with inner peace. The need for perfection and the desire for inner tranquility conflict with each other. Whenever we are attached to having something a certain way, better than it already is, we are, almost by definition, engaged in a losing battle. Rather than being content and grateful for what we have, we are focused on what's wrong with something and our need to fix it. When we are zeroed in on what's wrong, it implies that we are dissatisfied, discontent. Whether it's related to ourselves, a disorganized closet, a scratch on the car, an imperfect accomplishment, a few pounds we would like to lose, or someone else's imperfections, the way someone looks, behaves, or lives their life, the very act of focusing on imperfection pulls us away from our goal of being kind and gentle. This strategy has nothing to do with ceasing to do your very best, but with being overly attached and focused on what's wrong with life. It's about realizing that while there's always a better way to do something, this doesn't mean that you can't enjoy and appreciate the way things already are. The solution here is to catch yourself when you fall into your habit of insisting that things should be other than they are. Gently remind yourself that life is okay the way it is right now. In the absence of your judgment, everything would be fine. As you begin to eliminate your need for perfection in all areas of your life, you'll begin to discover the perfection in life itself.
Be aware of the snowball effect of your thinking.
A powerful technique for becoming more peaceful is to be aware of how quickly your negative and insecure thinking can spiral out of control. Have you ever noticed how uptight you feel when you're caught up in your thinking? And, to top it off, the more absorbed you get in the details of whatever is upsetting you, the worse you feel. One thought leads to another, and yet another, until at some point you become incredibly agitated. For example, you might wake up in the middle of the night and remember a phone call that needs to be made the following day. Then, rather than feeling relieved that you remembered such an important call, you start thinking about everything else you have to do tomorrow. You start rehearsing a probable conversation with your boss, getting yourself even more upset. Pretty soon, you think to yourself, "I can't believe how busy I am. I must make 50 phone calls a day. Whose life is this anyway?" And on it goes, until you're feeling sorry for yourself. For many people, there's no limit to how long this type of thought attack can go on. In fact, I've been told by clients that many of their days and nights are spent in this type of mental rehearsal. Needless to say, it's impossible to feel peaceful with your head full of concerns and annoyances. The solution is to notice what's happening in your head before your thoughts have a chance to build any momentum. The sooner you catch yourself in the act of building your mental snowball, the easier it is to stop. In our example here, you might notice your snowball thinking right when you start running through the list of what you have to do the next day. Then, instead of obsessing on your upcoming day, you say to yourself, "Whew, there I go again," and consciously nip it in the bud. You stop your train of thought before it has a chance to get going. You can then focus not on how overwhelmed you are, but on how grateful you are for remembering the phone call that needed to be made. If it's in the middle of the night, write it down on a piece of paper and go back to sleep. You might even consider keeping a pen and paper by the bed for such moments. You may indeed be a very busy person, but remember that filling your head with thoughts of how overwhelmed you are only exacerbates the problem by making you feel even more stressed than you already do. Try this little exercise the next time you begin to obsess on your schedule. You'll be amazed at how effective it can be.
Remind yourself that when you die, your in-basket won't be empty.
So many of us live our lives as if the secret purpose is to somehow get everything done. We stay up late, get up early, avoid having fun, and keep our loved ones waiting. Sadly, I've seen many people who put off their loved ones so long that the loved ones lose interest in maintaining the relationship. I used to do this myself. Often, we convince ourselves that our obsession with our to-do list is only temporary, that once we get through the list, we'll be calm, relaxed, and happy. But in reality, this rarely happens. As items are checked off, new ones simply replace them. The nature of your in-basket is that it's meant to have items to be completed in it. It's not meant to be empty. There will always be phone calls that need to be made, projects to complete, and work to be done. In fact, it can be argued that a full in-basket is essential for success. It means your time is in demand. Regardless of who you are or what you do, however, remember that nothing is more important than your own sense of happiness and inner peace and that of your loved ones. If you're obsessed with getting everything done, you'll never have a sense of well-being. In reality, almost everything can wait. Very little in our lives truly falls into the emergency category. If you stay focused on your work, it will all get done in due time. I find that if I remind myself frequently that the purpose of life isn't to get it all done, but to enjoy each step along the way and live a life filled with love, it's far easier for me to control my obsession with completing my list of things to do. Remember, when you die, there will still be unfinished business to take care of. And you know what? Someone else will do it for you. Don't waste any more precious moments of your life regretting the inevitable.
Don't interrupt others or finish their sentences.
It wasn't until a few years ago that I realized how often I interrupted others and/or finished their sentences. Shortly thereafter, I also realized how destructive this habit was, not only to the respect and love I received from others, but also for the tremendous amount of energy it takes to try to be in two heads at once. Think about it for a moment. When you hurry someone along, interrupt someone, or finish his or her sentence, you have to keep track not only of your own thoughts, but of those of the person you're interrupting as well. This tendency, which, by the way, is extremely common in busy people, encourages both parties to speed up their speech and their thinking. This, in turn, makes both people nervous, irritable, and annoyed. It's downright exhausting. It's also the cause of many arguments, because if there's one thing almost everyone resents, it's someone who doesn't listen to what they are saying. And how can you really listen to what someone is saying when you are speaking for that person? Once you begin noticing yourself interrupting others, you'll see that this insidious tendency is nothing more than an innocent habit that has become invisible to you. This is good news because it means that all you really have to do is to begin catching yourself when you forget. Remind yourself, before a conversation begins, if possible, to be patient and wait. Tell yourself to allow the other person to finish speaking before you take your turn. You'll notice right away how much the interactions with the people in your life will improve as a direct result of this simple act. The people you communicate with will feel much more relaxed around you when they feel heard and listened to. You'll also notice how much more relaxed you'll feel when you stop interrupting others. Your heart and pulse rates will slow down, and you'll begin to enjoy your conversations rather than rush through them. This is an easy way to become a more relaxed, loving person.
Do something nice for someone, and don't tell anyone about it.
While many of us frequently do nice things for others, we are almost certain to mention our acts of kindness to someone else, secretly seeking their approval. When we share our own niceness or generosity with someone else, it makes us feel like we are thoughtful people. It reminds us how nice we are and how deserving we are of kindness. While all acts of kindness are inherently wonderful, there is something even more magical about doing something thoughtful but mentioning it to no one, ever. You always feel good when you give to others. Rather than diluting the positive feelings by telling others about your own kindness, by keeping it to yourself, you get to retain all the positive feelings. It's really true that one should give for the sake of giving, not to receive something in return. This is precisely what you are doing when you don't mention your kindness to others. Your rewards are the warm feelings that come from the act of giving. The next time you do something really nice for someone else, keep it to yourself and revel in the abundant joy of giving.
Create patience practice periods.
Patience is a quality of heart that can be greatly enhanced with deliberate practice. An effective way that I have found to deepen my own patience is to create actual practice periods, periods of time that I set up in my mind to practice the art of patience. Life itself becomes a classroom, and the curriculum is patience. You can start with as little as 5 minutes and build up your capacity for patience over time. Start by saying to yourself, "Okay, for the next 5 minutes, I won't allow myself to be bothered by anything. I'll be patient." What you'll discover is truly amazing. Your intention to be patient, especially if you know it's only for a short while, immediately strengthens your capacity for patience. Patience is one of those special qualities where success feeds on itself. Once you reach little milestones, 5 minutes of successful patience, you'll begin to see that you do indeed have the capacity to be patient, even for longer periods of time. Over time, you may even become a patient person. Since I have young children at home, I have many possibilities to practice the art of patience. For example, on a day when both girls are firing questions at me as I'm trying to make an important phone call, I'll say to myself, "Now is a great time to be patient. For the next half hour, I'm going to be as patient as possible. See, I've worked hard. I'm up to 30 minutes. All kidding aside, it really works, and it has worked in our family. As I keep my cool and don't allow myself to be annoyed and upset, I can calmly, yet firmly, direct my children's behavior far more effectively than when I get crazy. The simple act of gearing my mind towards patience allows me to remain in the present moment far more than I would if I were upset, thinking about all the times this has happened before and feeling like a martyr. What's more, my patient feelings are often contagious. They rub off on the kids, who then decide, on their own, that it's no fun to bother Dad. Being patient allows me to keep my perspective. I can remember, even in the midst of a difficult situation, that what's before me, my present challenge, isn't life or death, but simply a minor obstacle that must be dealt with. Without patience, the same scenario can become a major emergency, complete with yelling, frustration, hurt feelings, and high blood pressure. It's really not worth all that. Whether you're needing to deal with children, your boss, or a difficult person or situation, if you don't want to sweat the small stuff, improving your patience level is a great way to start.
Ask yourself the question, will this matter a year from now?
Almost every day, I play a game with myself that I call Time Warp. I made it up in response to my consistent, erroneous belief that what I was all worked up about was really important. To play Time Warp, all you have to do is imagine that whatever circumstance you are dealing with isn't happening right now, but a year from now. Then simply ask yourself, is this situation really as important as I'm making it out to be? Once in a great while it may be, but a vast majority of the time, it simply isn't. Whether it be an argument with your spouse, child, or boss, a mistake, a lost opportunity, a lost wallet, a work-related rejection, or a sprained ankle, chances are, a year from now, you aren't going to care. It will be one more irrelevant detail in your life. While this simple game won't solve all your problems, it can give you an enormous amount of needed perspective. I find myself laughing at things that I used to take far too seriously. Now, rather than using up my energy feeling angry and overwhelmed, I can use it instead on spending time with my wife and children or engaging in creative thinking.
Surrender to the fact that life isn't fair.
A friend of mine, in response to a conversation we were having about the injustices of life, asked me the question, who said life was going to be fair, or that it was even meant to be fair? Her question was a good one. It reminded me of something I was taught as a youngster. Life isn't fair. It's a bummer, but it's absolutely true. Ironically, recognizing this sobering fact can be a very liberating insight. One of the mistakes many of us make is that we feel sorry for ourselves or for others, thinking that life should be fair or that someday it will be. It's not, and it won't. When we make this mistake, we tend to spend a lot of time wallowing and/or complaining about what's wrong with life. We commiserate with others, discussing the injustices of life. It's not fair, we complain, not realizing that, perhaps, it was never intended to be. One of the nice things about surrendering to the fact that life isn't fair is that it keeps us from feeling sorry for ourselves by encouraging us to do the very best we can with what we have. We know it's not life's job to make everything perfect. It's our own challenge. Surrendering to this fact also keeps us from feeling sorry for others because we are reminded that everyone is dealt a different hand and everyone has unique strengths and challenges. This insight has helped me to deal with the problems of raising two children, the difficult decisions I've had to make about who to help and who I can't help, as well as with my own personal struggles during those times that I have felt victimized or unfairly treated. It almost always wakes me up to reality and puts me back on track. The fact that life isn't fair doesn't mean we shouldn't do everything in our power to improve our own lives or the world as a whole. To the contrary, it suggests that we should. When we don't recognize or admit that life isn't fair, we tend to feel pity for others and for ourselves. Pity, of course, is a self-defeating emotion that does nothing for anyone except to make everyone feel worse than they already do. When we do recognize that life isn't fair, however, we feel compassion for others and for ourselves. And compassion is a heartfelt emotion that delivers loving kindness to everyone it touches. The next time you find yourself thinking about the injustices of the world, try reminding yourself of this very basic fact. You may be surprised that it can nudge you out of self-pity and into helpful action.
Allow yourself to be bored.
For many of us, our lives are so filled up with stimuli, not to mention responsibilities, that it's almost impossible for us to sit still and do nothing, much less relax, even for a few minutes. A friend of mine said to me, "People are no longer human beings. We should be called human doings." I was first exposed to the idea that occasional boredom can actually be good for me while studying with a therapist in Laconia, Washington, a tiny little town with very little to do. After finishing our first day together, I asked my instructor, "What is there to do around here at night?" He responded by saying, "What I'd like you to do is allow yourself to be bored. Do nothing. This is part of your training." At first, I thought he was kidding. "Why on earth would I choose to be bored?" I asked. He went on to explain that if you allow yourself to be bored, even for an hour or less, and don't fight it, the feelings of boredom will be replaced with feelings of peace. And after a little practice, you'll learn to relax. Much to my surprise, he was absolutely right. At first, I could barely stand it. I was so used to doing something every second that I really struggled to relax. But after a while, I got used to it and have long since learned to enjoy it. I'm not talking about hours of idle time or laziness, but simply learning the art of relaxing, of just being rather than doing, for a few minutes each day. There isn't a specific technique other than to consciously do nothing. Just sit still, perhaps look out the window and notice your thoughts and feelings. At first you may get a little anxious, but each day it will get a little easier. The payback is tremendous. Much of our anxiety and inner struggle stems from our busy, overactive minds always needing something to entertain them, something to focus on, and always wondering what's next. While we're eating dinner, we wonder what's for dessert. While eating dessert, we ponder what we should do afterward. After that evening, it's, what should we do this weekend? After we've been out, we walk into the house and immediately turn on the television, pick up the phone, open a book, or start cleaning. It's almost as though we're frightened at the thought of not having something to do, even for a minute. The beauty of doing nothing is that it teaches you to clear your mind and relax. It allows your mind the freedom to not know for a brief period of time. Just like your body, your mind needs an occasional break from its hectic routine. When you allow your mind to take a break, it comes back stronger, sharper, more focused and creative. When you allow yourself to be bored, it takes an enormous amount of pressure off of you to be performing and doing something every second of every day. Now, when either of my two children says to me, "Daddy, I'm bored," I respond by saying, "Great, be bored for a while. It's good for you." Once I say this, they always give up on the idea of me solving their problem. You probably never thought someone would actually suggest that you allow yourself to be bored. I guess there's a first for everything.
Once a week, write a heartfelt letter.
This is an exercise that has helped to change many lives, assisting people in becoming more peaceful and loving. Taking a few minutes each week to write a heartfelt letter does many things for you. Picking up a pen or typing on a keyboard slows you down long enough to remember the beautiful people in your life. The act of sitting down to write helps to fill your life with gratitude. Once you decide to try this, you'll probably be amazed at how many people appear on your list. I had one client who said, "I probably don't have enough weeks left in my life to write everyone on my list." This may or may not be true for you, but chances are there are a number of people in your life or from your past who are quite deserving of a friendly, heartfelt letter. Even if you don't have people in your life to whom you feel you can write, go ahead and write the letter to someone you don't know, perhaps to an author who may not even be living, whose works you admire, or to a great inventor or thinker from the past or present. Part of the value of the letter is to gear your thinking toward gratitude. Writing the letter, even if it isn't sent, would do just that. The purpose of your letter is very simple: to express love and gratitude. Don't worry if you're awkward at writing letters. This isn't a contest from the head, but a gift from the heart. If you can't think of much to say, start with short little notes like, "Dear Jasmine, I woke up this morning thinking of how lucky I am to have people like you in my life. Thank you so much for being my friend. I am truly blessed, and I wish for you all the happiness and joy that life can bring. Love, Richard." Not only does writing and sending a note like this focus your attention on what's right in your life, but the person receiving it will, in all likelihood, be extremely touched and grateful. Often, this simple action starts a spiral of loving actions, whereby the person receiving your letter may decide to do the same thing to someone else, or perhaps will act and feel more loving toward others. Write your first letter this week. I'll bet you'll be glad you did.
Repeat to yourself, life isn't an emergency.
In some ways, this strategy epitomizes the essential message of this audiobook. Although most people believe otherwise, the truth is life isn't an emergency. I've had hundreds of clients over the years who have all but neglected their families as well as their own dreams because of their propensity to believe that life is an emergency. They justify their neurotic behavior by believing that if they don't work 80 hours a week, they won't get everything done. Sometimes I remind them that when they die, their in-basket won't be empty. A client who is a homemaker and mother of three children recently said to me, "I just can't get the house cleaned up the way I like it before everybody leaves in the morning." She was so upset over her inability to be perfect that her doctor had prescribed her anti-anxiety medicine. She was acting and feeling like there was a gun pointed at her head and the sniper was demanding that every dish be put away and every towel folded, or else. Again, the silent assumption was, this is an emergency. The truth was, no one other than she had created the pressure she was experiencing. I've never met anyone, myself included, who hasn't turned little things into great big emergencies. We take our own goals so seriously that we forget to have fun along the way, and we forget to cut ourselves some slack. We take simple preferences and turn them into conditions for our own happiness. Or we beat ourselves up if we can't meet our self-created deadlines. The first step in becoming a more peaceful person is to have the humility to admit that, in most cases, you're creating your own emergencies. Life will usually go on if things don't go according to plan. It's helpful to keep reminding yourself and repeating the sentence, "Life isn't an emergency."
Become a better listener.
I grew up believing I was a good listener, and although I have become a better listener than I was 10 years ago, I have to admit I'm still only an adequate listener. Effective listening is more than simply avoiding the bad habit of interrupting others while they are speaking or finishing their sentences. It's being content to listen to the entire thought of someone rather than waiting impatiently for your chance to respond. In some ways, the way we fail to listen is symbolic of the way we live. We often treat communication as if it were a race. It's almost like our goal is to have no time gaps between the conclusion of the sentence of the person we are speaking with and the beginning of our own. My wife and I were recently at a cafe having lunch, eavesdropping on the conversations around us. It seemed that no one was really listening to one another. Instead, they were taking turns not listening to one another. I asked my wife if I still did the same thing. With a smile on her face, she said, "Only sometimes." Slowing down your responses and becoming a better listener aids you in becoming a more peaceful person. It takes pressure from you. If you think about it, you'll notice that it takes an enormous amount of energy and is very stressful to be sitting at the edge of your seat trying to guess what the person in front of you, or on the telephone, is going to say so that you can fire back your response. But as you wait for the people you are communicating with to finish, as you simply listen more intently to what is being said, you'll notice that the pressure you feel is off. You'll immediately feel more relaxed, and so will the people you are talking to. They will feel safe in slowing down their own responses because they won't feel in competition with you for airtime. Not only will becoming a better listener make you a more patient person, it will also enhance the quality of your relationships. Everyone loves to talk to someone who truly listens to what they are saying.
Choose your battles wisely.
Choose your battles wisely is a popular phrase in parenting, but is equally important in living a contented life. It suggests that life is filled with opportunities to choose between making a big deal out of something or simply letting it go, realizing it doesn't really matter. If you choose your battles wisely, you'll be far more effective in winning those that are truly important. Certainly, there will be times when you will want or need to argue, confront, or even fight for something you believe in. Many people, however, argue, confront, and fight over practically anything, turning their lives into a series of battles over relatively small stuff. There is so much frustration in living this type of life that you lose track of what's truly relevant. The tiniest disagreement or glitch in your plans can be made into a big deal if your goal, conscious or unconscious, is to have everything work out in your favor. In my way of thinking, this is nothing more than a prescription for unhappiness and frustration. The truth is, life is rarely exactly the way we want it to be, and other people often don't act as we would like them to. Moment to moment, there are aspects of life that we like and others that we don't. There are always going to be people who disagree with you, people who do things differently, and things that don't work out. If you fight against this principle of life, you'll spend most of your life fighting battles. A more peaceful way to live is to decide consciously which battles are worth fighting and which are better left alone. If your primary goal isn't to have everything work out perfectly, but instead to live a relatively stress-free life, you'll find that most battles pull you away from your most tranquil feelings. Is it really important that you prove to your spouse that you are right and she is wrong, or that you confront someone simply because it appears as though he or she has made a minor mistake? Does your preference of which restaurant or movie to go to matter enough to argue over it? Does a small scratch on your car really warrant a suit in small claims court? Does the fact that your neighbor won't park his car in a different part of the street have to be discussed at your family dinner table? These and thousands of other small things are what many people spend their lives fighting about. Take a look at your own list. If it's like mine used to be, you might want to reevaluate your priorities. If you don't want to sweat the small stuff, it's critical that you choose your battles wisely. If you do, there will come a day when you'll rarely feel the need to do battle at all.
Become aware of your moods, and don't allow yourself to be fooled by the low ones.
Your own moods can be extremely deceptive. They can, and probably do, trick you into believing your life is far worse than it really is. When you're in a good mood, life looks great. You have perspective, common sense, and wisdom. In good moods, things don't feel so hard. Problems seem less formidable and easier to solve. When you're in a good mood, relationships seem to flow and communication is easy. If you are criticized, you take it in stride. On the contrary, when you're in a bad mood, life looks unbearably serious and difficult. You have very little perspective. You take things personally and often misinterpret those around you as you impute malignant motives into their actions. Here's the catch. People don't realize their moods are always on the run. They think instead that their lives have suddenly become worse in the past day or even in the last hour. So, someone who is in a good mood in the morning might love his wife, his job, and his car. He is probably optimistic about his future and feels grateful about his past. But by late afternoon, if his mood is bad, he claims he hates his job, thinks of his wife as a nuisance, thinks his car is a junker, and believes he's going nowhere in his career. If you ask him about his childhood while he's in a low mood, he'll probably tell you it was extremely difficult. He will probably blame his parents for his current plight. Such quick and drastic contrasts may seem absurd, even funny, but we're all like that. In low moods, we lose our perspective and everything seems urgent. We completely forget that when we are in a good mood, everything seems so much better. We experience the identical circumstances, who we are married to, where we work, the car we drive, our potential, our childhood, entirely differently depending on our mood. When we are low, rather than blaming our mood, as would be appropriate, we instead tend to feel that our whole life is wrong. It's almost as if we actually believe that our lives have fallen apart in the past hour or two. The truth is, life is almost never as bad as it seems when you're in a low mood. Rather than staying stuck in a bad temper, convinced you are seeing life realistically, you can learn to question your judgment. Remind yourself, of course I'm feeling defensive, or angry, frustrated, stressed, or depressed. I'm in a bad mood. I always feel negative when I'm low. When you're in an ill mood, learn to pass it off as simply that, an unavoidable human condition that will pass with time if you leave it alone. A low mood is not the time to analyze your life. To do so is emotional suicide. If you have a legitimate problem, it will still be there when your state of mind improves. The trick is to be grateful for our good moods and graceful in our low moods, not taking them too seriously. The next time you feel low, for whatever reason, remind yourself, this too shall pass. It will.
Choose being kind over being right.
You are given many opportunities to choose between being kind and being right. You have chances to point out to someone their mistakes, things they could or should have done differently, ways they can improve. You have chances to correct people privately as well as in front of others. What all these opportunities amount to are chances to make someone else feel bad and yourself feel bad in the process. Without getting too psychoanalytical about it, the reason we are tempted to put others down, correct them, or show them how we're right and they're wrong is that our ego mistakenly believes that if we point out how someone else is wrong, we must be right, and therefore we will feel better. In actuality, however, if you pay attention to the way you feel after you put someone down, you'll notice that you feel worse than before the put-down. Your heart, the compassionate part of you, knows that it's impossible to feel better at the expense of someone else. Luckily, the opposite is true. When your goal is to build people up, to make them feel better, to share their joy, you too reap the rewards of their positive feelings. The next time you have the chance to correct someone, even if their facts are a little off, resist the temptation. Instead, ask yourself, what do I really want out of this interaction? Chances are, what you want is a peaceful interaction where all parties leave feeling good. Each time you resist being right and instead choose kindness, you'll notice a peaceful feeling within. Recently, my wife and I were discussing a business idea that had turned out really well. I was talking about my idea, clearly taking credit for our success. Chris, in her usual loving manner, allowed me to have the glory. Later that day, I remembered that the idea was actually her idea, not mine. Whoops! When I called her to apologize, it was obvious to me that she cared more for my joy than she did her own need to take credit. She said that she sees enjoying me happy and that it doesn't matter whose idea it was. Do you see why she's so easy to love? Don't confuse this strategy with being a wimp or not standing up for what you believe in. I'm not suggesting that it's not okay for you to be right, only that if you insist on being right, there is often a price to pay, your inner peace. In order to be a person filled with equanimity, you must choose kindness over being right most of the time. The best place to start is with the next person you speak to.
When in doubt about whose turn it is to take out the trash, go ahead and take it out.
If we're not careful, it's easy to become resentful about all the responsibilities of daily living. Once, in a very low mood, I figured out that on average, I do over 1,000 different things. Of course, when I'm in a better mood, that number is significantly lower. As I think about it, it's astounding to me how easy it is for me to remember all the chores that I do, as well as all the other responsibilities that I take care of. But, at the same time, it's easy for me to forget all the things that my wife does on a daily basis. How convenient. It's really difficult to become a contented person if you're keeping score of all you do. Keeping track only discourages you by cluttering your mind with who's doing what, who's doing more, and so forth. If you want to know the truth about it, this is the epitome of small stuff. It will bring you far more joy to your life to know that you have done your part and someone else in your family has one less thing to do than it will to worry and fret over whose turn it is to take out the trash. The strongest argument against this strategy is the concern that you'll be taken advantage of. This mistake is similar to believing it's important that you're right. Most of the time, it's not important that you're right, and neither is it important if you take out the trash a few more times than your spouse or housemate. Making things like garbage less relevant in your life will undoubtedly free up more time and energy for truly important things.
Every day, tell at least one person something you like, admire, or appreciate about them.
How often do you remember, or take the time, to tell people how much you like, admire, or appreciate them? For many people, it's not often enough. In fact, when I ask people how often they receive heartfelt compliments from others, I hear answers like, "I can't remember the last time I received a compliment. Hardly ever. And sadly, I never receive them." There are several reasons why we don't vocally let others know about our positive feelings towards them. I've heard excuses like, "They don't need to hear me say that. They already know." And, "I do admire her, but I'm too embarrassed to say anything." But when you ask the would-be recipient if he or she enjoys being given genuine compliments and positive feedback, the answer 9 times out of 10 is, "I love it." Whether your reason for not giving compliments on a regular basis is not knowing what to say, embarrassment, feeling that other people already know their strengths and don't need to be told, or simply not being in the habit of doing it, it's time for a change. Telling someone something that you like, admire, or appreciate about them is a random act of kindness. It takes almost no effort once you get used to it, yet it pays enormous dividends. Many people spend their entire lifetimes wishing that other people would acknowledge them. They feel this especially about their parents, spouses, children, and friends. But even compliments from strangers feel good if they are genuine. Letting someone know how you feel about them also feels good to the person offering the compliment. It's a gesture of loving kindness. It means that your thoughts are geared towards what's right with someone. And when your thoughts are geared in a positive direction, your feelings are peaceful. The other day, I was in the grocery store and witnessed an incredible display of patience. The checkout clerk had just been chewed out by an angry customer, clearly without good cause. Rather than being reactive, the clerk diffused the anger by remaining calm. When it was my turn to pay for my groceries, I said to her, I'm so impressed at the way you handled that customer. She looked me right in the eye and said, Thank you, sir. Do you know you are the first person ever to give me a compliment in this store? It took less than 2 seconds to let her know, yet it was a highlight of her day and of mine.
Remember that everything has God's fingerprints on it.
Rabbi Harold Kushner reminds us that everything that God has created is potentially holy. Our task as humans is to find that holiness in what appear to be unholy situations. He suggests that when we can learn to do this, we will have learned to nurture our souls. It's easy to see God's beauty in a beautiful sunrise, a snow-capped mountain, the smile of a healthy child, or in ocean waves crashing on a sandy beach. But can we learn to find the holiness in seemingly ugly circumstances, difficult life lessons, a family tragedy, or a struggle for life? When our life is filled with the desire to see the holiness in everyday things, something magical begins to happen. A feeling of peace emerges. We begin to see nurturing aspects of daily living that were previously hidden to us. When we remember that everything has God's fingerprints on it, that alone makes it special. If we remember this spiritual fact while we are dealing with a difficult person or struggling to pay our bills, it broadens our perspective. It helps us to remember that God also created the person you are dealing with, or that despite your struggles to pay your bills, you are truly blessed to have all that you do. Somewhere in the back of your mind, try to remember that everything has God's fingerprints on it. The fact that we can't see the beauty in something doesn't suggest that it's not there. Rather, it suggests that we're not looking carefully enough or with broad enough perspective to see it.
Resist the urge to criticize.
When we judge or criticize another person, it says nothing about that person. It merely says something about our own need to be critical. If you attend a gathering and listen to all the criticism that is typically levied against others, and then go home and consider how much good all that criticism actually does to make our world a better place, you'll probably come up with the same answer that I do. Zero. It does no good. But that's not all. Being critical not only solves nothing, it contributes to the anger and distrust in our world. After all, none of us likes to be criticized. Our reaction to criticism is usually to become defensive and/or withdrawn. A person who feels attacked is likely to do one of two things. He will either retreat in fear or shame, or he will attack and lash out in anger. How many times have you criticized someone and had them respond by saying, Thank you so much for pointing out my flaws. I really appreciate it. Criticism, like swearing, is actually nothing more than a bad habit. It's something we get used to doing. We're familiar with how it feels. It keeps us busy and gives us something to talk about. If, however, you take a moment to observe how you actually feel immediately after you criticize someone, you'll notice that you'll feel a little deflated and ashamed, almost like you're the one who has been attacked. The reason this is true is that when we criticize, it's a statement to the world and to ourselves, I have a need to be critical. This isn't something we are usually proud to admit. The solution is to catch yourself in the act of being critical. Notice how often you do it and how bad it makes you feel. What I like to do is turn it into a game. I still catch myself being critical, but as my need to criticize arises, I try to remember to say to myself, There I go again. Hopefully, more often than not, I can turn my criticism into tolerance and respect.